Okay, I'm rolling.
We'll do this again. I hope we'll do it continuously. But I mean, what did we learn? What did you learn, Charles? None of us had been in Tower Street before, right?
I've been in Tower Street before.
You have to check it. I was trying to get you.
Professor, I'm going to come in a little. Scoot in a little.
What did we learn seeing this dramatic story in the flesh? Charles, you start.
What I learned is that there's an incredible, enormous, untapped talent among Jamaican's population, particularly those who are in prison. And there's a hopefulness, which is unlike what I see in a lot of prisons, where there's hopelessness. And that there is a commissioner who's almost magical. I have never seen a person in charge of corrections who has had so much love shown by the people with whom he works.
Let's talk about this. I mean, because it's fascinating. You wouldn't pick him off a sidewalk in New York as Mr. Charisma, but he got the biggest applause.
Right.
His deep, nothing but love. I mean, respect even among dissident prisoners who don't believe in the rehab program, love Colonel Prescott. What's that about?
Charlie, what do you think?
He was willing to be real about the environment that they live in. He spoke to them directly from the moment he got there and confronted the problems that were real in their lives, and they respect him for it.
He also believes in them. That's the hard thing. I mean, it's easy to say, I believe in you. I didn't give you this sentence. I didn't bring you here. But he believes in them not just to be a caretaker of some set, but he's a true caregiver, that he gave them something by saying, I'll take a chance on letting you go because I think that you could be my neighbor. I've never heard a commissioner say, I hope you'll live in my neighborhood. That's a remarkable man. And I think a lot of this is about him, and my biggest concern is that if he does leave, as it looks like he will, whether it will be possible to sustain this at the level that it's at without a Prescott there as the sort of intellectual and emotional spiritual force behind it.
Yeah, that's well said. What about the whole rehab premise? I mean, did you buy it? Are you shaking in it at all, Charlie? I mean, what do we think?
Well, I have no doubt at all that if prisons operated as correctional institutions on principles of rehabilitation, that something truly transposing would happen in the world. That is, what we're seeing here is a movement toward peace, law and order, that's starting in the Kingston prisons with the criminals. I mean, where better to start a movement to peace and law and order than with the criminals? So I have no doubt that this is a wonderful path if it's possible to follow it.
It's remarkable another way. I thought it was quite amazing that not only the commissioner, but the teammates, the inmates, the residents, were all uniform in their view that the prisoner who did escape was, in a sense, the black sheep of the family. But he had done dishonor to an important program. And their sense that, you know, we know we've done bad things, but we respect the authority of the law that brought us here. And you have denied that respect by deciding to step outside and take off on your own. I thought that was sort of remarkable, that it is unique that this community is so committed to the real idea of rehabilitation. I mean, it's not just a word. I think it's not fully developed. But what I saw, it's the small, important things. That is that people are learning to write. They're learning to read. They're learning math. And they came into the prison without that. Now, the prison clearly is not fully equipped to do all of that, but the fact that somebody can learn to write, and as I saw this morning, a girlfriend showed me her boyfriend's work and learned to do math problems and wrote her a love letter. because he's in prison, right? If he's out on the streets of Jamaica, he wouldn't be in school. He wouldn't have the skill. And so it's a slow incremental process that's revolutionary. The people who have given up on the system, now we have their attention. Now they're in a system of discipline, and now they're becoming empowered. At the end, they're holding up these signs about empowerment, you know, reintegration. So,
what were those signs? I couldn't read them.
They were saying that productive lives through reintegration. That is that, you know, we want to get back into the community, and that we want to be empowered in the sense that the furloughs were a way to help people. But it was nothing, you know, let me go or, you know, I'm innocent. It was clearly, you know, we want to be part of the community. And they had the right terms, the right forms, and it was the right place.
Desmond Green is really the philosopher of this movement. And he talks about seven principles, of which when you ask him to list them, the first is breathing. His idea of reverence for life and the way you get in touch with it has got this kind of Eastern quality that it has to do with breathing and being in touch with yourself. And if you become conscious of your breathing, you are actually acting to respect yourself. And this is the beginning, this is the starting point for the reverence for life. The second on his list is word. And word has fascinated me since he used it to describe the suit of clothes that the spirit wears. It's what we present to the world. And as he explains it, language is so important to what these people are trying to do, so that he has teammates. Prescott's word is, I have clients. The prisoners are my clients. I treat them as clients. And that role just allows him to understand what the right thing is to do. It's very much like lawyers representing clients.
Absolutely.
What is the right thing to do for my client?
Well, it's like lawyers in another way trying to problem solve, because what Prescott said that was remarkable to me was, we have work to do. It's not just my clients, it's my staff. That the staff has to be disciplined to understand that these men are trying to do better. And when the men did the skit today, the mirror image was the guards are insensitive, they're incorrigible, they're like what prisoners would normally be, right? I mean, they're fighting, they're angry, they're dismissive. And his message, I think, in front of all the inmates was that we have to do a better job. And I think also that the Thompson, who was released, made the point very powerfully. Those who are cheering for Prescott are the teammates. The guards want him to go. This is hell for them. Inmates feeling empowered, talking about reintegration, going home and coming back. Our job is to keep them here to show it's a failure. It's self-interest and professional interest. And I think it pointed out very clearly.
But let me say, I was impressed when doing interviews at the correctional office. When the question came up of this escapee, the question was, well, what happens when he gets caught, when he comes back? What happens if he surrenders? One could think of various ways in which that could happen. Their immediate response was that they were going to need to protect him, because to put him in with the inmate population of the Kingston prisons, when he has deprived them of family visits and their program has been suspended, I thought that was a wonderful, caring kind of reaction on the side of the staff, that is, that wing of the guards that has swung over to this movement, and it definitely is one.
I want to go back to just sort of the first premises. I just, in terms of keeping my own head straight about what we were looking for or looking at, I kept thinking, you know, the big paradox that you'd be trying to explain over the dinner table back home is, we're in Kingston, the most notoriously violent city in the Caribbean, and we're finding this sort of
promise of peace, of a promise of prison reform, of idealism, of self-control, of all the good things that we're talking about.
And people say, what?
Come on, let's deal with it. We're in a place where a lot of the city is off limits. And you're kidding yourself. Are we kidding ourselves or not? I mean, is this a problem zone or is this a solution zone?
Is this another Jamaican scam? is this a bunch of, you know, after all, who are these people? These are a bunch of liberal Harvard lefties that have gone to Jamaica. They're probably all loaded, for Christ's sake. And there they are, thinking it's all hearts and flowers. That's it. That's the question. Is it all a scam?
And my answer is that I've been doing this a long time, and it's a tough thing to do, and it's hard to apologize for the ugly side of the justice system we often see, and some of us even create. But here, it's different, and the difference is palpable. There are young men with guns and drugs in the community who are violent, who are uneducated, and who would kill you in a New York second. No question about that. And that's the element that the community sees every day. That's why they want police to be tougher, people to be prosecuted and sentenced. They want the external pressure to be addressed. But in that facility, it's amazing. Think about it. There were 1,400 men, all of them serving serious time, and here are all these largely white and male, some female, folks from America there. It was a good chance to hustle us, right? I'm innocent. You could have heard that 1,400 times. I didn't hear it. I heard it, but I didn't hear it 1,400 times. The whole idea that let's make life uncomfortable for them, I felt welcomed. I felt a sense that they were happy that we were there. And the inmates outnumbered the guards. They didn't have to cooperate. There's nothing they could do. You're serving a 45-year sentence. They can't punish you anymore. And I think they really think they're on to something. And I think that our skepticism is important. A healthy skepticism is important, but we also have to report what we see and come back to see if it continues. I think that inmate who got up there, who even denied that he was guilty of a crime of which he was tried and convicted, even with all of his hostility about going through the system, being on death row, he's saying, I want you to survive. I want you to be mature. I want you to learn how to read and write, and I want you to learn a skill. Don't just spend your time here. And so, to me, that was a classic case of somebody who made the system work for them, right? And whether it's a Wall Street banker or whether it's some other slick person, I think that they have used their talents to turn things in a way that's very positive. The other thing that's important is that I was amazed by the culture and the performances. With all those performances, you'd expect everybody's going to try to out-rap and out-reggae everyone else. The minority of the music today was reggae. It was spiritual and gospel and had a larger message, pop. And that was sort of surprising to me, that these guys are serious. And they disciplined, right? Marching in order and synchronized singing and that whole idea of becoming a family. This is not their family, but it's become their family. So I think that's something you don't normally see at such a large scale in one place. I, for one, am at the moment prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt because it's so unusual.
One prisoner toward the end, actually an English man. We met a number of Englishmen. I mean, it was London accents, and all of them, I think, had been caught leading with drugs. A number of them, including this guy, had done time in England and talked about prison here, prison there. And this last guy, his name was Leo, said, you've got to be kidding. I mean, seriously, you guys from North America, your technology, your culture, you're coming here to learn about prisons. This is a joke. And I've been in England where your prison reform ideas have spilled over, and there's no comparison. That's a civilized system over there. This is a joke. This is chicken, poops. And he was I didn't have to push him to shove. He was militant for Prescott. But he thought, this has got to be some kind of a joke, you guys coming down here to imagine rebuilding your prison system. I have my own answer to that, but I wonder what yours is.
Well,
let me answer first, because I have an answer, because it's amazing that it's not surprising, but amazing that he would say that, because I don't think he even realizes what's going on in the prisons. I can't imagine the prisons in America where you'd have 100 men who are murderers and rapists and robbers and drug dealers who would tolerate one guard controlling them. Those inmates in a moment could take over that institution. I don't see any motivation for that. I don't see any sense, even though it's one of the most decrepit and poorly conditioned and understaffed places I've ever seen.
A lot of guys in Cincinnati did not have mattresses.
Right. I mean, let's just think about that. Think of all the things that would create an environment for violence and for people to want to respond against the guards and respond against each other. And so we can learn something, because our sense is that when we've got a lot of people, we have to have one guard for every 7 inmates, right? And we have to lock them down, and we have to do all, you know, we have to control their movement every hour. We can't let them lift weights because they'll get strong and hurt us. We can't let them get involved in entertainment because they'll want to go out and they can't go out. And Jamaica's saying, we're doing all these things without the resources. If you want to read, you can do that. If you want to write, you can do that. If you want to be a musician, you can do that. If you want to get on a computer, you can do that. They have zero resources without letting people do something constructive and productive, and we don't even think about that at all. And so it's the joke is that we have a system with more resources than any other in the world, and we're not at all preparing anybody to come out and be resourceful. And they want to be resourceful. Those guys on the stage, they all want to make it. It's not just to get out. They think they have real talent, and they want to use it in some way. That, to me, is a remarkable cultural phenomenon that it's hard to describe it. You have to see it. You can't write about it. People think that you're crazy, but if you see it, you can say, gosh, they really care. I mean, they really have hope. They really think they're going to make it. And I saw that today. I've seen it before. And I don't see that in prisons anywhere else.
I took your question differently. You're talking when you say Leo, I don't think I got the man's name, but you're talking about that incredibly sculptured character with a shaved head from London.
Another guy, Robert.
Robert.
He was an English guy who we caught.
Well, from his point of view, this prison is terrible. Terrible. Prescott comes into office. He sees this place that's how old? Trier, I think it's 150 years old. And it definitely a culture that was lock him up, throw away the key, and just, you know, beat him into submission. And he's not had any increase in budget to speak of. So he's been working with, as he says, a budget that after he barely feeds them, he can squeeze like 12% to do new kinds of program of any kind. From that point of view, Leo or Mr. America or Mr. Jamaica or Mr. London, I guess he would be, that place is really something. He said, if it wasn't for the gym, I'd go crazy here. There's absolutely nothing to do. Nothing to do. And that left me into thinking about Thaddeus Miles, whose basic strategy in the mass housing projects is to put some technology in, because the technology opens up a window that lets you go wherever you want to go. And I think that's a part of the message that's happening here too. That is, our part of this is to follow through in some way on the promise of technology bridge the digital divide. And the idea that somehow through the introduction of an understanding of technology, which in this world, this time, this era, means an understanding of media and media creation. With that, you can bridge a divide. It's a form of education which is a key to development. And when you get the idea, you go with it. But these people got the idea. That the amazing thing in this story to me, this was a story where Prescott comes into office as corrections commissioner, coming from a military background, not corrections, seeing the place that just offends him as a military man. It's just grubby and dirty. He does his best to clean it up. He starts an environment that's conducive to the development of self-respect. Into that environment comes Desmond Green, who has a philosophy and the amazing ability to relate to every human. You cannot walk down a street with this man without being stopped every 5 seconds with somebody else shaking his hand. And this movement grows, which threatens the guards just as you say, Chris, exactly as you say. And they hate it. That eventually comes to a crisis where the guards go out on strike. They walk out of the prison, leaving it, they expect, to chaos and riot. And at that moment, these prisoners became teammates. They figured out that they didn't need to play the part that the guards had scripted for them. They didn't need to riot and make it clear that the guards need to come back in and beat the crap out of everybody and reestablish order. So they kept peace. And to this day, at least the hearsay report is, that there are still 700 guards that have never come back to work. They just don't need that many guards if the teammates are willing to run an orderly environment. So this is the kind of click of the mind, a kind of insight about the way power works. It's like an understanding of the Japanese principle of Aikido, which is the art of receiving a blow and allowing your opponent to fall. So that's a connection that's going to go. It's going to go. And yet, at the same time, you can't be in that room without understanding how precarious it all is, too. And it really is this extraordinarily interesting thing to look at and to be part of.
Incredibly interesting. I want to redirect the question in a way, but also give you my answer on why, you know, I think there's something extremely exemplary here, even though the conditions are primitive, to say the least. I mean, that building has been condemned probably for 100 years. It's a joke. But that is, you know, under the general rubric of the spiritual heading, we kept hearing extraordinary stories, you know, redemptive stories, turnaround stories, life stories. Guys saying, they would always preface it by saying, it has to begin inside each man, but it had begun in them, a rethinking, a discovery of a kind of spiritual identity, Christian or otherwise, although a lot of them Christian, in ways that were very, very touching to me. I mean, I think the thing that's hardest to talk about, and we haven't yet, but is most significant about what we've been through was the spirit of this day. Now, and Colonel Prescott is very, very discreet about sort of never revealing it. And Brother Green is very hard to pin down on what these seven principles are. I mean, starting with breathing and ending with generosity, it's hard to say just what this is all about. And yet, the men in the prison clearly share some
discovery of fraternity, spiritual experience, kind of consciousness first, and it seems to me somewhere in that zone is the real secret of what attracts us here, what makes us feel this is a most unusual day. And it was not just about policy or what was it about? I mean, there is a spiritual X factor here that we haven't touched on yet.
It was a coming together of intelligence. I feel it most directly with Desmond. I feel personally that I've come in contact with Desmond's intelligence and felt that room to be a room full of people who, on the one hand, had come in contact with Desmond's intelligence, the people in that room that knew him, and on the other, people in the room that knew me. That's the way it felt to me. It felt to me like a coming together of intelligences to form a kind of space that was shared, so that when you looked around the room, you got looks from people that were knowing. They were collaborative. We were part of the same show.
Right. Agreeing on something.
Yes, yes. Who are the actors? Who are the players?
What is it?
Exactly. Okay. We were real together in a way that expressed the goodness in our hearts, along with a practical strategy for making it real in the world, using the power of narrative, basically the power to generate media.
Well, there's a similar sense that I had, in that the connection was very powerful with all the teammates, and that they really appreciated us for who we were. I mean, the thing about it is that they gain nothing by applauding us or accepting us. We can't lessen their sentence. We can't grant them a furlough. But we were people who were saying, we're willing to listen and hear your story. And they told a powerful and articulate story. And I think that says a lot about the deep culture. The other thing that I found so powerful, and that Desmond sort of reflects this, is the idea of family and community, that there is a real sense of community, that people aren't rejected, they aren't dismissed, they aren't ostracized because of their misdeeds. They are as much a part of the family today. And I saw that from a mother this morning who has a 19-year-old son who's been sentenced to 45 years. And she's coming twice a week, every week. She's bringing him food. She's trying to get him transferred to another place. You know, and she had, I guess it was maybe his grandmother, she had to be in her 60s. But her commitment to this young man was just, you could feel it. And that is something that you don't always see. She had nothing to offer him but a few biscuits and a little syrup and some dry fruit. But that, to her, that's half of what she used to survive, and she's going to give it to her son. Because for her, he has a death sentence, and she's trying to give him life. And that's the kind of caring that makes that 19-year-old say, instead of trying to escape or instead of stabbing another inmate, instead of refusing to read, someone cares enough for me that I'm going to try to do something at 19 that might make it possible for me to be out there with my grandmother before I die. That's the part that's remarkable here. And maybe it's just a bunch of stories, a bunch of case studies, but I have to tell you that it's amazing to find so many of them in one place, and it just tells me that family is broader and real and deeper than I've ever sensed it anywhere, and community is broader and deeper than I've ever sensed it anywhere. And I think that's the sense, and if you take those broad concepts and then apply them to what's happening in the prisons, that's a very, very healthy concept.
Can I just go back a step? Chris, let me ask you what your impression is of Camilla Rome.
Well, I've just seen her 24 hours now. She's really, she plays a big, big role, and it's a huge part. It's premature, Charlie. I don't want to duck it, but she was, I watched her today. She was kind of moving with the music. She was very much part of it. It's this kind of, I don't know, natural figure. I don't want to say Earth's Mother of Jamaica, but there's something of that. She is this kind of gorgeous queen, you know, very active, dramatic, beautiful, female, encouraging role. That's just a first slice, but I'm just beginning to see what she's up to.
She's the one who picked this out.
She
is the one who picked out this focus for the Berkman Center.
Really?
Yes. She was the person that I first partnered with when we came down for a conference in Port Antonio in 1998, where 20 or so people on my side met with 20 or so people on the Jamaican side and just mingled and got to know each other and talked about what the real problems of Jamaica were. And then Camilla came up to Cambridge for a conference in the year 2000.
She spoke of meeting at your house, and I said to Ben, we've got to get her to give an account of that thing, because she felt she came with a vision.
Yes, yes. That was a meeting last year, maybe a year and a half ago, dealing with South Africa, and sort of Charlie was hosting a dinner on behalf of some of our friends from South Africa. And she came there, and she completely turned the tables on us, because we had completely invested in the idea that to help Jamaica, the only way to help Jamaica was to use information technology to educate children. We were going to bring computers and take Jamaican children to the United States and come here. We were giving up on the current generation. We said the only hope is working with the children. And we were making progress. And she came and sort of destabilized that idea. Said, you know, I've got a prison project I want to talk to you about. Prison. What does that have to do with technology? What does that have to do with children? She said, well, I have an idea. And just dropped it in the air like that, like just enough to pique our curiosity, but not trying to persuade us. And as you think about it, the idea didn't make any sense. We've got a program where murderers are allowed to go home on weekends and they come back. That shows our cultural barriers. That's unthinkable. A murderer goes home and comes back. Ridiculous. And so she had a hard time persuading us of that. And in fact, I think our initial reaction was very defensive. We need social scientists. We need to study this over 20 years with 30,000 people and 5 million cases before you can prove it. The idea just doesn't make any sense. And you probably have one guy who went home and came back. We don't believe it. And that was what sort of the startling part, that she, who has no expertise in prisons, no expertise in rehabilitation, no expertise in parallels, her field is technology. And yet she says, here is a part of Jamaica's future, unlike other countries that we aren't going to ignore. Most countries have said that generation is gone. They have no skills. They're pariah on society. It's a waste to try to invest in them. Let's give that generation up and go backward. And she said, no, I want to try to save this generation. And that to me is a fascinating challenge that she placed on our shoulders.
It's so interesting. Well, I would just say my one short form at the end of a day would be simply that there is a kind of a spiritual vitality in a premise here that is driving what sounds like legal and administrative reform here, and we haven't pinned it down yet. Should we pause there for the moment and then pick it up tomorrow? Did you want to say something, Charlie?
No, I was just... Your question's one that calls for thought. It's like you were asking, what is the deep spirit of what we saw here today? I mean, we all feel we experience something.
We don't have the tools. We don't have the equipment to understand it. That's what makes it fascinating.
Mm.
It's, you know, but that's part of Western culture. Let me find the answer.
Amen.
Right.
This is,
there's a formula here. There's a recipe here. We're looking for it, and what we see is fantastic. But you know, I it's a gimmick, and I'm not convinced. What is it? Is it faith? Is it hope? Is it manipulation? You know, what is it? And we just don't know, which makes it remarkable. Let's see by it.
Well, I have fun.
Go ahead.
Actually, a thought to offer. As I listen to two of you, my wife, Fern, has a hypothesis. We discussed this in the form of, well, all right, maybe it's not real, but just assume it is real. Assume we go down to Jamaica and we bring to bear an army of analytic talent examining the reality of this thing, and we conclude it's real. What would explain how this could be real in Jamaica and not real anyplace else in the world? And she said that perhaps there's something unique to the Jamaican character. Some rooting in the spirit of the Maroons that involves self-governance and deep articulation of Babylon that allows them to catch this insight, see the trick, and become the storytellers in their own lives. So maybe that was something we were part of.
That's a start. That's a good hypothesis. Let's work on it.
Okay.
The minutes are running down.
This is the Texas delegation, Steve Martin and Glenn Otis Brown. And the question is, what do we see today? I mean, and do we agree on what, if anything, we learned? Steve?
Well, I mean, the perspective I bring to a project like this is grounded in Eighth Amendment American constitutional law, in which I look at conditions of confinement and measure them by what I believe to be, you know, the existing law that relative to, you know, health and safety of a given population. I mean, are they being confined in a reasonably safe environment? Are they being provided the basic necessities of health care, health and sanitation, in a reasonably safe environment? Are they being employed or channeled into productive enterprises that reduces the idle time? Do you have a staff complement that is able to maintain a secure facility and physically control this population and make the surrounding population safe? So that's,
and the answer for Jamaica is?
That it fails on many, if not all, of those areas that I just mentioned. I mean, if you reduce that to a checklist, it is not a secure facility by any standard with which I'm familiar. It is not a healthy or safe environment. The basic necessities are not being routinely provided, and to an extent that it's basically a detriment to the population. I mean, when you have basic service delivery, say in a mental health care setting, in which you are placing four and five inmates in a 50 or 60 square foot cell with no hygiene facilities, with no lighting, very unsanitary conditions, that is a prescription to worsen or aggravate that human condition. It represents, in my view, the very antithesis of what care and custody of a government is all about. And I'm not talking about any level of sophisticated rehabilitation programs. I'm not talking about raising levels of technology. I'm talking about basic, healthy living in a 24-hour, 7-day environment.
But let me ask you, Steve, did you feel that the men there were unsafe, unhealthy, in danger, in trouble?
Well, certainly there are pockets of or elements of that facility today that I've visited that I would say yes. The answer to that is categorically, unequivocally yes, with respect to the care of mental health prisoners and prisoners that have been found to be mentally acutely ill or mentally incompetent that are being housed in that environment of 4 and 5 to a cell with no routine delivery of meds or healthcare professionals intervening and being attending to those populations. Certainly so. With respect to an idle population, if you have 1,465 inmates, of whom 200 or so are employed or have program slots where they do something during the workday, that leaves somewhere in excess of 1,000 inmates that are literally left to their own means in a population in which all kinds of things will emerge in terms of extortion, in terms of illicit drugs, in terms of abuse of vulnerable populations, the populations that are particularly vulnerable are what we need to be concerned with. It's not if an inmate is able to function, and most of them do, quite frankly, probably function well, or not well, but they get by in this type of environment. That's not who I'm concerned with. Who I'm concerned about are those that are dysfunctional, those that are vulnerable, those that don't have the wherewithal or don't have the community support, don't have people, their energy or whatever. I saw people there that had open sores, that had clothes that had not been laundered in God knows how long. Those people may not be the majority, but those are the people that are that I'm concerned with in this type of environment are being harmed.
They were telling us that they are light unto the nations here in terms of respect and rehabilitation and sort of regeneration of the spirit. Are they kidding themselves? Are they kidding us?
Well, one thing, let me caveat everything I've said, that this is just one day, you're getting a single day of impression. I do this for a living. I have for most of my career. It's analogous to if you walk up to a storefront and you have two windows to that storefront, and they put their best effort in those display windows. All your sin and all you should recognize that all your sin are what's literally in those two display windows. What's in those display windows may or may not be representative of what's in the store. To some extent, what this exercise was today, and in my view, was the window dressing. To the extent that you're going to generalize what you saw in that prepared show today, I'd just be very, very reluctant to generalize about a quote, the spirit of rehabilitation by that, and that's why I spent the bulk of my time. In fact, I spent very little time in that room today. Almost all of my time was literally going to all corners of the institution, talking to staff and inmates alike, in what I call the bowels of the institution. And
what did you find?
I found there's a stark contrast in what. What some of what I've heard in terms of the rehabilitative approach and what it, in actuality is the 24-hour, 7-day life in that facility. There's a huge void between the two thus far. And that's not to say, there's no one more supportive of rehabilitative programs than I am, and they're to be lauded and encouraged and made to flourish and so forth, but you cannot provide rehabilitative programs to a full population if you do not have an infrastructure, if you're not providing basic services to that population to where you're maintaining minimal levels of safety and health and sanitation, then the rehabilitative programs cannot be delivered to the bulk of the population. You can always deliver them to a small segment. You can direct outsiders to that small segment and say this is representative of what we're doing. And if the outsiders come in and that's all they see, and they have no reason to believe otherwise, then they walk away with one view. I did not see a serious commitment aside from rehabilitation to the provision of basic necessities of human habitation in that environment that I believe.
I understand. It did not pass your checklist. It flunks on virtually every count. Do you see among the men anything to sort of mitigate the judgment?
Among the men.
Yeah, among the inmates.
Yeah, well, it's something that I've done quite a bit of work in the Puerto Rican correctional system, which is there are certain similarities and so forth. And one thing that I saw today that I've seen for years, I've worked for years in the Puerto Rican system, is that these populations, these island populations, there's a good, strong continuity between family and incarcerated populations. There's a more understanding security force, because I think, again, a lot of these security personnel know many of their inmates, they know their families and so forth. So there's a more caring culture that's I think almost endemic to an island type of population. I saw that in Guam. I've seen it in Puerto Rico, to some extent in Northern Ireland and other places that I've been, in small jurisdictions stateside. And so I think that's probably what's at work here. A dynamic that's a very positive dynamic is, and it's a testament to the human condition, that these people will adjust and learn to function. But again, that's not, it's the mainstream prisoner is not my concern. My concern are those vulnerable populations, those populations that cannot fend for themselves, that are put 4 and 5 into a cell in different various states of mental distress, that are left there unattended. If we don't address and maintain and care for those folks like we should, it's just my belief that we don't move on to a higher goal of rehabilitation until we're in a position to say we're providing basically a safe environment for the bulk of the population.
Steve, what do you conclude about who's running the prison? Where does the power lie? This is a place with roughly half of its complement of warders or guards gone. Who's in charge there?
Well, the inmates clearly are through an equilibrium that you see established over time that they have unfettered access, number one, to the institution. In other words, they can move from point A to point B to point C. They can conduct their affairs fairly.
What does that say? I'm just struck that it was a remarkably free place. Guys could go from the gym to the yard to Reverence for Life.
Well,
a lot of the games.
Well, what that says is inmates are able to conduct their affairs with minimal interference from the guard force. The inmates are very acutely aware that is a fertile ground in which they can conduct their business. You will probably have in a population like that some relatively small number of real, honest, genuine power brokers in that population. Heavy hitters, individual inmates that are sophisticated, have connections to the community, and those are the folks that are probably, in terms of sheer raw power in that immediate environment, are the ones that...
Did you pick them out? Did you see
two? I certainly saw several. As I went through the institution, they're there. There's no question about that. And as long as those folks, have a understanding with the key security people or administration, then it can function really surprisingly quite well, even given this type of conditions.
Greg, your turn.
Well, I was just hoping that you would tell the anecdote you were telling me before about, Steve would tell the anecdote he was saying before about the interaction between some warders and some prisoners and how the power dynamics seemed to be switched over sometimes. There was a particular warder who was leading you around. And
right. There was a particular officer that I was with, and at times when I would pose a question or I would say where else do we need to go or I want to go here, there was a particular inmate that was obviously very articulate, dressed well, obviously held some type of power position that was almost on an equal footing with that warder in directing me by. And the warder would, I don't know whether it capitulates or proper, but the warder would defer to his judgment that, yes, let's take him and show him the pharmacy or let's take him, he needs to see this. And there was a mutual respect between that officer and that inmate, and that's what makes that institution run, is that type of dynamic. That officer could have said, get the hell away from here or whatever. That would have been a real problem at that point. An officer would know that's not a prudent course for him to follow, so he defers and says, yes, let's go there.
What did you make of Colonel Prescott? He was sort of embattled, but also a great hero.
I really don't have any comment on that at this point. I have pretty strong feelings about the provision of basic necessities in a prison environment, and when I don't see them, or I see them, the lack of them producing very aggravated circumstances, I'm bothered by that. I don't see any corrections professional with a strong sense of decency could walk through that institution like I did today and not be voicing with strong conviction, that we need to change some things, we need to improve some things. I'm very troubled by it. Yeah. So I'd prefer, just not to comment on his administration.
Greg.
Yeah, Glenn,
sorry, what am I saying? I'm sorry.
Introduce mine.
Glenn, give us your short form on the day. What are we seeing?
I'm glad you started it off asking what we saw. I saw more today in, I guess, 7-8 hours we were there. Possibly than I've seen in any 7-8 hour period of my life. But I'm more interested... more interested in what I didn't see. I have more questions about what I didn't see. I felt like I could spend a long time there. Not that I would want to, but there's many, many things. I'm interested in knowing how, I still never got a very good idea of how people get into the Reverence for Life movement. Who's included, who's excluded, to what extent it's up to the members or to the inmates themselves to get into it. If it's somehow chosen from above, or if it's a matter of them going and professing their faith and being a good inmate. I never got a clear answer on that. Interested in knowing where the money comes from for Reverence for Life. My understanding is that all the infrastructure, the instruments, the musical instruments, the computers, the really nice PA system, all of that stuff, someone from the Department of Corrections told me, comes from a nonprofit actually called Food for the Poor. I'm interested in knowing if it's really true that Food for the Poor actually buys these instruments and computers and all the other kind of infrastructure and gives them to the prison, or if they give them money and then some prison officials buy the stuff. I'm interested in knowing what exactly Food for the Poor is. I heard a few different stories. I noticed that there's a plaque over the tailor shop and the table shop that says the place was built by Food for the Poor. This was made possible by Food for the Poor. I understand that they give some medication to the hospital. I'm interested in knowing more about them. In general, just what the money flow is in the place. I'm interested in knowing about that because you see a nice PV amplifier and a bunch of other nice musical equipment in the building where I guess it was called the Light of Bloom band room. I'm interested in knowing why there's not an autoclave in the hospital. Interested in knowing if the mental patients, or the quote-unquote mental patients, ever get out. Never got a clear answer on that. Interested in knowing how the Jamaican criminal justice system works as far as declaring people unfit for trial. Because apparently, when you're declared unfit for trial, you're sent to prison and put in the George Davis Center, which is the mental center. And I'm just a lot of kind of invisible things, basically, is what I'm interested in seeing. And I was able to get some kind of statistics, basic statistics on how many people are in the prison, how many people work there, that kind of thing. But I guess most of the things I'm interested in are not going to be visible right on the surface.
It sounds to me as if you're doubtful that there's an example for the world here.
I don't know. I don't think I can judge just by what I saw and heard today. I guess it's fair to say I'm doubtful. I guess I'm doubtful about everything I come into on first impressions, though. So it's that's just kind of how I go at things. And so I can't really say yet, but I can't say that I was somehow let down today. I was very skeptical coming in and continue to be skeptical. And I mean, I think skepticism is just unanswered questions, and I've got a lot of them.
What was your impression of Colonel Prescott and the reception he got? He got more applause and a deeper applause than anybody we heard today, including the best of the dancers.
Yeah, he got a standing ovation. I mean, a lot of my unanswered questions are of my own fault. I haven't probably done enough reading in preparation for everything. I don't know Mr. Prescott's background at all. I don't know the history here. I can't really form an impression of him because I'm basically just baffled by the whole thing. I was very, very curious why he got a standing ovation. Not to say that I assumed that he shouldn't, but I wanted to know the reasons why behind that. And that's about all I can say about it, I guess.
Well, I'd be interested to see what type of reception that he would receive going back into the George Davis mental health unit. Because that would tell me more about the real, down to the ground, rubber meets the road administration of that facility than a contrived, anticipated, orchestrated presentation of a relatively small part of the population vis-a-vis going back to the areas of the facility that I visited and that really define, in my view, define the commitment of the administration to run a safe facility.
Thank you both, and we'll continue it tomorrow. We'll sleep on all of it. Thank you.